Before we start this episode, we wanted to share the sad news of the passing of our friend, colleague, and episode guest, Dr. Andrea Marie Chagoux. Andrea was such a force at DUSP, and this episode gives a sneak peek into what it was like to take one of her classes, explore research with her at the Real Estate Innovation Lab, or understand her commitment to innovation by co-founding the entrepreneurial incubator DesignX. Andrea had a brilliant mind, and her drive to leave the world better than she found it permeates our entire conversation. The passion, rigor, and humility she brought to the work left an indelible mark on us in this conversation, and we suspect it might leave a mark on you too. We dedicate this episode to Andrea.
Welcome back to the Planning Ideas That Matter podcast from MIT Department of Urban Studies and Planning. I am Samra Lacko, MCP class of 2020. If you don't know, that's a Master of City Planning.
And I'm Tiffany Ferguson, MCP 2018. And now that you know who we are, let's get into the episode.
So, real estate, if you didn't know, that's the topic. And particularly, how has the real estate industry been impacted by COVID? At times, we heard it was booming, and at times, we heard that cities were emptying out and downtowns were vacant. We also learned recently that institutional investors have entered the single-family housing market in a big way. There are so many different moving pieces to this story, and we wanted to get to the bottom of it. You cannot talk about planning without talking about land, and you cannot talk about land without talking about money and power.
When we were planning this episode, we expected to hear a lot more about remote workers leaving cities in droves and the end of the office as we knew it. But instead, our speakers helped us take a step back and see a much bigger and contextualized picture of real estate over time, both in the U.S. and in Nigeria. We entered this episode wanting to know, did this prolonged moment of disruption, aka the pandemic, did it in any way shift the real estate industry's appetite toward a more equitable or sustainable world? To help us learn more about the study and practice of real estate and how it was impacted by the pandemic, we spoke with MIT researcher Andrea Chagoux and MIT Center for Real Estate alum Kayode Agbalajobi. They both give us a lot of food for thought. Let's start with Andrea.
I'm Dr. Andrea Chagoux. I'm director and co-founder of MIT's Real Estate Innovation Lab. I am the co-founder and head of research for SA&P's DesignX Venture Accelerator, and I'm a research scientist at the Center for Real Estate. My background is in real estate finance, and I specialize at the intersection of automation, data science and machine learning, climate change, and social justice issues that are impacting the commercial and residential real estate space. And last bit is the Real Estate Innovation Lab is an interdisciplinary team of students and researchers who come together with a fabric of either design planning or finance or statistics background. We come together to answer questions of what needs to change in the built environment and whether or not there's a financial or a policy outcome that can shift.
And here's Kayode.
My name is Kayode Agbalajobi, former architect, now real estate investor, background in design and architecture in Lagos, Nigeria, moved to the U.S. in 2019, spent a year at grad school, and now I work for a real estate investment trust based out of D.C. We own, operate, and manage and build office buildings in D.C., the DMV area, Boston, and Austin. I work on the asset management team, and I'm personally responsible for two buildings in the DC area.
So we have Andrea with a background in real estate finance and economics, and Kayode, architect turned real estate investor and asset manager. Now, before we jump into how the industry has or hasn't been impacted by the pandemic, we really wanted to ground ourselves in a definition. What exactly are we talking about when we say real estate?
Real estate, in French, it's immobilier, so it's the anything that's immovable. The essence of it is it's the place where we do stuff. It's place, either the place where we sleep, or it's the place where we work and make stuff, or it's the place where we make new things, or it's the production of things. And so it's the physicality of that and understanding the physicality of that. But then there's also the abstract layers of that. It's who is that? Who's in there? Who is doing that? Who is owning that? Who is paying for that? And it is across all of our functions of society. So on any given day, I can talk about industrial real estate, which includes everything from a manufacturing plant to a distribution facility to a shed to, and I do talk about sheds, to also people's homes, the buying and selling of people's homes, which is a big part. A lot of real estate people talk about the buying and selling of homes. I like to pay attention to these other types of real estate because they are, again, a big part of this wealth generating process. Of course, offices and retail spaces and restaurants, but also there's real estate or elements of the financing around the in-between. So the streets and the sidewalks and the parks and the fountains and the urban fabric, as I would borrow from my urban designers and the people who trained me in the land of urban design.
I certainly was not expecting the question to take us in that direction, but Andrea was able to provide a lot of context and definition around real estate concepts that I think can easily be taken for granted, especially as a planner, but are necessary to revisit, especially in this conversation. I don't think I had heard a definition quite like this one. I think what really intrigued me was the discussion about the returns of innovation going back to real estate. I think this framing explains some of the things that we know intuitively about San Francisco, about DC, about Boston, and other cities that have famously high rent, but ties it back very concretely to the innovation in the industry.
There were so many aha moments in this interview. For me, one of the most surprising was the story of commercial real estate over the 20th century. I found it really interesting, and I think you will too. Here's a clip of that conversation.
So I do like history. I think to be in the built environment, you tend to love history because the grooves of the city and the grooves of our experience usually were laid hundreds of years ago. I don't know if you know Phoebe Holtzman. Shout out to Phoebe Holtzman. Great planning alumni. We did a 400-year history of a New York City block. That was her master's thesis, looking at a 400-year history of a New York City block. And the grooves from a river on that block still make certain elevators hard to install in the buildings there on that block to this day. And you sit there and you look at it and you go, that's like just tracing that sort of groove in history and that groove in the landscape and the groove in the way that it was and how long it sort of takes things to shift and move and change was an extraordinary case study because it was one block. But then we also looked at all the other block studies. So there's a whole genre of block studies. People do these block studies in planning and in real estate. And there's also these long run, 400, 500 year history studies out there. Actually, a couple done by my PhD supervisor, Professor Pete Eichholz, and some of his colleagues. He did like the 400 year history of the Herengracht, which is the canal in Amsterdam. It looks at the housing there and what happened to prices and housing over hundreds of years in that block. So looking at the long run trajectory of history of real estate, look, ownership of land, ownership of real estate is a long running contentious issue amongst economists, but also is the principal means of ownership and control, and also where the returns to all innovation and all growth ultimately return to. I mean that quite seriously. So if you're innovating in a physical space, or you're a startup and you're innovating, the rents will increase over time to capture more and more of the growth in your innovation. It's a part of how the capitalist system has evolved over time. I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong, but it is how it sort of evolved over time. So the trajectory of land ownership and the trajectory of growth has been in this way that the returns to a lot of our growth has gone to these landowners. That's how this has been going for the better part of a thousand years. It used to be, landed gentry. It's a whole totally different conversation, but it used to be like this in a far greater unequal scenario. And then everyday people, mainly heterosexual white males, were able to gain access. And then after that, over time, it took about another 900 years before many more people were able to gain access to the buying and selling of land, with women and people of color being the most recent additions, but not more than 100 years ago, which is an extraordinary thing if you think about it. So the wealth and the concentration of wealth and land ownership being historically male and white has been the greater part of the history of our earth. And it really hasn't been until the greater part of 100 years ago that we've actually been working out the kinks of giving more and more people access to equal land ownership. And even then, it's contentious, right? So gaining access to the capital to buy it is often guarded and kept away, either from women or from people of color for various reasons, in various means, in various ways. There's been various systemic policies in banking and discriminatory practices that many colleagues of mine in DUSP have discussed, and many colleagues of mine in the real estate community have certainly discussed. And so we know that that is there in commercial real estate. So now if we were to switch over to commercial real estate, that problem is even more exacerbated, because this is the ownership of the returns to employee and industrial capital. Right. So this is the returns to our wealth in our productive income making society. And so that is predominantly owned by, you know, those that are not diverse in nature. They're corporations, and those corporations are not diverse in nature. So when you're really digging into the equality or the sort of the nature of this sort of issue, we've never really dug into it. One, because we've never had the data science for it. We never really, you know, it's all embedded in paper records. So people haven't really looked at the long run history of this, but the vast majority of ownership has been predominantly concentrated in the hands of very few. And over time, that's been sort of tugged at and grabbed at. But there's still a long journey to go. And that income inequality, that feeling of income inequality that we have, that big overarching sleeping giant that we're sitting with of extraordinary income inequality in not only in housing, but also in commercial real estate wealth, it's just there also because it's got this long historical groove in it. And so we've got to, like, through policy, through democratic processes, through activism and through protest, we've got to stand up for those rights to keep gaining access to those means of wealth and point out discrimination. But yes, the long trajectory of history has been not on the side of equality for the vast majority of it, but it has moved in the past 100 years, but not without an extraordinary fight, a continued fight in today's, and also today's climate is an extraordinary fight. So on the one hand, it's like really like, oh God, we haven't done much. But on the other hand, it's going very fast. So I'm incredibly proud of the work in the past 100 years, if you think about it, right? Like 100 years ago, my life as a woman would have been extraordinarily different. My access to property would have been incredibly different. My access to a credit card, my access to a loan, just would have been incredibly different.
See what I mean when I said she gave a history lesson, or rather a human history lesson? There's one part that stands out most for me, and it's that in the last 100 years, we are looking at the most radical departure from how land in the West has been allocated and distributed. And the only reason that that's true is because folks have fought really hard for those gains. In the next clip, she really talks about how this trajectory is not inevitable. Here's her getting more into the weeds of the finance and politics of real estate ownership.
We've had an explosion in who actually owns commercial real estate. So that has changed over time. So we have more people owning more assets in commercial real estate. So the pie of who owns what has gotten bigger. The pie itself has also gotten bigger. So we make more stuff. And in economics, we call that expanding the margin. So we've expanded the margin of what's possible. We've expanded the margin of actual physical buildings. But we've also expanded who's gaining access to that. There's two things happening there. So there's some people who are getting concentrated amounts of wealth even within that system, but there's also more people who are gaining access to the system. So the rise of certain, we call it financial innovations, but crowdfunding, or when you can actually fractionally share an asset. Fractional shares is one of the most important things that has happened in the better part of the last 50 years in finance, where more people can buy a fraction of ownership into an asset. And that's been exacerbated recently by the development of certain platforms where more people are buying into the fractionalization or the fractional shares of things. So there's this democratic process through fractional ownership that's happening. And at the same time, there are those who have already accumulated a great deal of wealth who are buying up more and more of that existing margin. So, and we're not necessarily extending the margin. One more complication to this, especially when it comes to housing, we haven't really extended the margin of the supply of housing very well or very much, certainly in the United States, but actually around the globe. And so we've got the better part of 500 million more people on Earth since we've had the biggest building boom in history. So that was the 1970s, 1980s. That's when we built a ton of real estate, certainly in the United States and in Europe. We haven't had such a building boom since that time. And so because we've kind of slowed down in the amount of immovable immobilier that we've actually been putting up, we don't actually have enough for everybody. The last part I'll add to this is we have some policies where we're not adding more to the stock, but we're also having policies that enable certain concentrations of ownership to happen. So there's favorable lending policies and favorable taxation policies that allow within certain environments for people to buy up or grab up a lot of real estate and own a lot of it. And so those that are trying to get into the ecosystem or trying to be a part of the system don't have enough capital, or they don't have enough a better tax treatment yet because they don't qualify to gain access to the system. That's changing. And I think also with the addition, the adding of more space and the fractionalization of shares, I think that changes somewhat, but not enough. So that's not enough to move the equality game enough. If you're not participating, I'm worried, because then we're not taking advantage of the wealth building that we have access to. But if you're not in the land ownership component, then you're not getting that big return to innovation, those big capital gains that are leading to that wealth building exercise that women and people of color are all too aware of. They're like, wait, I'm very aware of my lack, my historical in access to land and what that's meant for my wealth building exercise in the contemporary neoliberal capitalist system.
I love the history lesson, but I cannot help myself. There's too much temptation here to bring up that you, Tiffany, have entered into the class of homeowners while we were recording this episode, and in fact, taking advantage of the wealth building that we have access to, quote unquote. You are one of the people taking advantage of the new pieces of the pie that are being made available. So I bet you feel really good about that, especially at this time.
Thank you, Samra, for putting my business out there. But yes, it is true. I do feel really good about my investment. And it is something, right, to be able to say that last year in 2021, I, Tiffany Ferguson, officially joined the landowning gentry. I think it's kind of nuts. And I still have a little bit of inner conflict about it, because for much of my 20s, I held this belief that owning a home was a money trap. And as I've grown, obviously, I've come to understand that it doesn't have to be that. And for a lot of folks who have an investor mindset, a home is an asset that can be leveraged many times over for wealth creation and wealth building. And so with respect to whether the pie got bigger or the world is less unequal because one more Black person bought a home and I'm contributing to this historical trend of more diversity of property owners, yeah, maybe, I guess that's a great thing, sort of in the aggregate. But if I really wanted to get in the game of building wealth and leveraging this asset that I now have, or let's say a whole community wants to do this and really use it to redress neighborhood level inequality, for example, we are still 100 years behind. And we'll hear more from Coyote on just how undemocratic access really is to real estate ownership.
Yeah, so I mean, as you did allude to, the two different looks, like how it looks in Nigeria and how it looks in the US, are a bit different. I think for the US, and I have some bias here, but I think the accredited investor definition in the US has to die. Like, the idea is, you know, you're saving people from, you know, Ponzi's and being scammed, but really all you're doing is preventing people from ever accessing investments, except they have, you know, a certain amount of money or a certain amount of financial knowledge. I think if people can go to Vegas and, you know, put their money in a slot machine and hope to get money out, then I think people should be allowed to invest in whatever. So if Harvard, you know, is building, you know, a nice new campus and, you know, I live near there and I want to invest, why lock me out? Why say, you know, I don't have enough money, or why say I'm not an accredited investor according to the SEC? I don't have up to $1 million. No, I have this $5,000 that I have saved from, you know, my bonus over the years, and I want to invest it. Why not? So I think where there's room for change in the US investing scene, and this is not just real estate, this is across board, is democratizing access to investments. Like if I have $1,000, if I have $500 and there's an opportunity to invest in something that might give me returns, or, you know, I might lose everything, whatever, I think I should be given that opportunity. Now, how that looks in Lagos, it's pretty much the same, but, you know, there's no accredited investor definition, thankfully. So an average Joe who manages to raise $1,000 can invest $1,000 and get, you know, $2,000 and invest again, or can lose everything. So as Tiffany said, there is no safety net, and sorry. But what that also does is people then become active with their investments. I'm not just putting $1,000 into this thing and going to sleep. No, I'm going to actively monitor what's going on with my $1,000. And I think, aside the, you know, state capture issues we have back in Nigeria, I think it's a more equitable and fair system than, you know, saying for you to invest in these kinds of things, you have to be an accredited investor first. I think that's just gatekeeping.
And going into this episode, as Tiffany mentioned earlier, we almost expected that the pandemic would be a quote unquote game changing disruption. And that really turned out not to be the case.
Prior to, I think it's like, what, March 12th, 2020, when we were all told to go home and not come back to school, what happened prior to that time was really a focus on automation, climate change, health and well-being outcomes in the built environment, and concepts like income inequality and social justice issues around inequality around race, gender. All of these aspects were coming up in our research on a day-to-day basis. And it was also coming up with partners of the lab in industry that we intersected with all of the time. They were asking these questions. We were asking these questions. Our students were asking these questions. And after March 12th, that went on steroids. So I'd say what we were working on was needed. And then after that, the pandemic just accelerated so many of those questions. Yes, there was a lot more questions around, will we ever go back to the office, and could we do other things with offices, or could we do other things with physical spaces, and will people ever return to work? Those questions have certainly popped up. So I'm not going to ignore the elephant in the room. But the bigger problems that we were already seeing have been exacerbated by the pandemic. So income inequality is at its highest level that we've ever seen in the history of the world since we've been measuring such barometers. The climate change issues are becoming extraordinary. Heating days, flooding, how it's going to impact the built environment, displacement and migration issues. We saw the pandemic through the pandemic and the ongoing levels of the pandemic that we are still facing those challenges. Health and well-being outcomes certainly came to the forefront more so because all of a sudden lobbies and office buildings have become this sort of triage space for whether or not you're well or unwell and can go into the building. So those issues became, of course, front of mind, but health and safety is now critical for occupancy and participation in society, especially when you're talking at this enterprise institutional level and the sort of the legality of being in physical space and responsibility of actually the owners and tenants of being in that space. And then, of course, equality. The equality and access to being in the space is one element of it, but also equality and access to actually ownership has become an extraordinary issue during this time because of just absolutely dumbfounding amounts of income inequality that we've never seen anything like it before. As an economist, you're just like, wow, that's really extraordinary. So we're in very, very special times, and the topics we were talking about prior to the pandemic were important. And now when people say, well, would you change anything? I'm like, I would just do more and deeper and harder on what we were doing, because those problems have just gotten, I would say, more challenging in the face of the pandemic, in my opinion. That's been my experience.
So the quick recap here is that before the pandemic, in the academic context, folks were really focused on real estate and climate change, health outcomes in the built environment, and automation. Once the pandemic blows onto the scene, we're talking a lot more about income inequality, questions of occupational health and safety, and equity and ownership.
Spoiler alert, this is a reoccurring theme for us throughout the recording journey of this podcast. This is exactly why we wanted to talk to Coyote. We have a lot of alumni who work in real estate, and Coyote was the person we thought of because of his work, particularly with office space, which we heard early on was one of the most impacted sectors in commercial real estate, but also because his particular role was during the pandemic being tasked with figuring out how to maintain the profitability of these assets.
I interned here first before I started working here in October. So I interned between May and August. And my role really was just, you know, then they were they. We're an office owner with about 18 assets all over the country. And the big thing was, all right, COVID is here. How do we reposition our assets in response to COVID? So that was a, you know, 2-month exercise, worked with, you know, the entire company from investments to asset management, operations, IT. And the big takeaway was how much of the flux we were in as at, you know, April 2020 is the new normal, and how much we'd be looking to, you know, just do something for the meantime and then transition back to the old normal, you know, shortly after. I mean, I can tell you that even the most pessimistic projections as at April 2020 did not think we'll still be here as at March 2022, but we kind of are. And, you know, right now, I think we're not expecting, you know, any return to normal ever. So a lot of my work was taken on, which is probably why they were like, all right, we need to have this guy full time. But many of those things will be here to stay. You know, we're not going to stop doing, you know, cameras. We're not going to stop having counting cameras. We're not going to stop tracking occupancy and indoor air quality. That those things have just become, you know, permanent part of our, you know, product offering.
So here we have this very large, legacy, traditional industry pivoting and adapting in the wake of the tremendous impact the pandemic had on commercial office space. And from what I'm hearing from Coyote, it sounds like the greatest challenge is balancing short and long-term innovation. Here's more of Coyote on an effort he's been working on that's both innovative and long-term, and also persisted through the pandemic, even as conversations were percolating about pivoting or looking for new strategies.
I'll say the biggest one is indoor air quality management. We followed some research from Harvard. There's a guy called Joseph Allen and his partner, May Comber. They've worked on this topic called healthy buildings. And, you know, they set, you know, 9 foundations, and 3 of those foundations have to do with the air in a building. I think the U.S. is very familiar with the sick building syndrome, and, you know, where buildings are making people sick. We've kind of transitioned from that, but where we're trying to push the frontiers on is how can our buildings make the people in them more productive, you know, make them healthier, you know, give them air that feels like fresh air, like you're outside even though you're inside. How are we tracking the carbon dioxide levels within a space? Because apparently the more CO2 in a space, I mean, if it goes over 1,000 parts per million, I can geek about this, but if CO2 is over 1,000 parts per million for more than 15 minutes, people start to lose concentration. They start to get dizzy, which is why, you know, many times I have dozed off during meetings, even though I might not doze off at my desk. So we've paid a lot of attention to that. We have a sensor program with a company called Senseware. We've installed the sensors in every part of our building, rolling this out across the entire portfolio. Right now, we've done about 12 buildings, but we're going to 18. And the action plan is the sensors report to our BMS what the, you know, oxygen levels are, what the particulate matter is, like dust and stuff, and then what the volatile compounds, like, you know, scents and perfumes and, you know, even gas from human beings. So the sensors report to the BMS what those levels are, and then our buildings automatically respond either by increasing air rates or, you know, letting in more fresh air, or, you know, sometimes it might just be, you know, tell a building engineer to go and check what's going on in that space. So it's been fun. And, you know, it's doing what many other people have not done, which I find interesting. But, you know, it's been great, you know, and our customers so far have been responding well.
So from Coyote, we're hearing that real estate owners are interested in improving the quality and experience of customers within buildings to help maintain their income from their assets and how they all tie back to the bottom line. Whereas Andrea had a totally different take on how to improve return on investment for real estate owners and at the same time benefit the public good.
I'll give you a very concrete example. So I really want commercial real estate developers to invest a heck of a lot of money in trees. It is our biggest human contributor to fighting climate change. It's actually one of the biggest things that we are doing as a society to just combat what we do on a daily basis. Plant trees, plant trees, plant trees. It seems like a silly thing. We could also change our behaviors. And I believe one of the most important papers I think we as a team have ever written was about how commercial real estate developers need to plant more trees and how it's financially important for them to do it for their bottom line, but also what it does for society overall, from a health benefits perspective, from a community building perspective, from an equality perspective, and from a climate change perspective. Trees are like the biggest bang for your buck. And so when I talk to people and I go out and I sort of have that conversation, you know, I understood trees. I understood trees in relation to buildings. I understood street level greenery in relation to buildings and its road networks and its sidewalks and its building heights and design equation. But I also understood it in relation to its financial performance in terms of rents and transaction prices. And I related that back and I communicate that back out to stakeholders. If you're listening and you're a commercial real estate developer or want to be one, never get rid of your trees. It's the biggest bang for your buck. And it helps everyone. It helps society. It creates equality. It's an amazingly important thing to do. I'm a huge tree advocate after that study. It's a plug. It's a shameless plug for trees. But that's an example of, we do a lot of work that spreads across economics and finance, and it involves the who, what, when, where, and why. There's history involved, but there's a lot of understanding the non-physically changing asset or the non-physically changing building or the non-physically changing park in the short term and what its impact is.
Okay, so we heard a lot from our two speakers who are super knowledgeable in their spheres of influence. I think there's a lot to think over, but what immediately jumps out at me is the fact that nothing is different, but everything is different. And that I mean, the pandemic exacerbated existing issues within real estate, whether it's affordable housing, access to investment, sustainability, healthy buildings, commute, you know, micromobility, all of those things have existed before and will continue to exist. But the exacerbation has created a new appetite for ideas and creative solutions that maybe wasn't present before. And so in some ways, the audience is different because you're falling on, these ideas are falling on new ears. And this is a theme that we're going to explore more throughout the season. A second takeaway is the effect of trees on quality of life in cities. Andrea is a very big champion of trees, as you heard, and their ability to improve quality of life, health outcomes, and heat island effect in cities and things like that. But there is a world here where, you know, back to creative solutions, that there's a precedent for trees in the global south, which I did focus on in my time at DUSP, and so did Tiffany. But countries like Zaire, Uganda, and Ethiopia have focused on planting trees as a means to fight food insecurity. So things like avocado trees, banana trees, mango trees being planted in public areas and being able to feed populations that don't have access to stable food. And that kind of seems outside of the box here in the U.S. But if we're thinking of creative solutions, that's something that might be of interest, knowing that our unhoused population has been growing. Third takeaway is about housing stock and the stock of real estate. I think Andrea focused on the strides that have been made in land ownership and the access to investment. But we heard from Coyote that even with that, the U.S. is still quite unfair, and it's impossible to talk about this topic without talking about race and the impact that has had on access to home ownership. And now that we have more competition for housing, I foresee that it will get harder unless people really focus on this issue. It's not going to continue arcing towards positive without, you know, the same advocates working on this issue in the long term. Thanks to today's guests.
Andrea Shagu and Kayode Agbalajobi.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Planning Ideas That Matter podcast, a production by the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Our theme song was composed and recorded by DESP alumni band Eminent Domain. Other music in the season by Blue Dot Sessions. This season is co-hosted by Tiffany Ferguson and Samra Lako. Co-produced by Takeo Kuwabara, Dave Lashansky, Tiffany Ferguson, and Samra Lako. Our audio engineer is Dave Lashansky. This season is made possible through the generosity of the Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at MIT in the form of BEMIS funding and through the support of DESP's headquarters, faculty, and staff. Thank you. And we would like to extend a special thank you to all of our faculty and alumni guests for their time and reflections. Until next time.